Centre for Public Christianity. You're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Now, there's no denying the influence of religion on Western art. From Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel ceiling, you know, the creation of Adam is a familiar scene. The hands of God and Adam have been reproduced countless times. And Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper to the use of Christian symbols like the cross or the image of the Madonna. It's pretty inescapable.
But sometimes it's not so obvious. Take, for example, Jean-Baptiste Siméon Chardin. Are you impressed with my pronunciation
there, Simon?
He was a French painter in the 18th century, and he was considered a master of the still life genre. That is, art depicting mostly inanimate, commonplace items like a bowl of fruit or a vase of flowers, a water jug or a book. One of his works, The White Tablecloth, currently hangs in the Art Institute of Chicago. The scene is anything but remarkable. There is, of course, a table covered in a white tablecloth. On the table, a torn loaf of bread, two wine glasses, one full and upright, the other awkwardly fallen over and lying on its side, a knife with its handle hanging over the edge of the table, and a partially eaten sausage, maybe a salami or something, on a plate. Next to the table, on the floor, is kind of a big brown bucket, and inside that, a couple of containers that might be filled with water. It's all very natural, ordinary. But then there's another painting you can see in the Louvre in Paris. It's by Charles Lebrun, a 17th century French painter, who was known as King Louis XIV's first painter, and who was also responsible for decorating the famous Hall of Mirrors at Versailles. The painting is called Sainte Famille de la Bénédicité, or The Holy Family Saying Grace, and it was commissioned in 1651. The subject, the Holy Family, Joseph, Mary, and Jesus, immediately before their flight into Egypt. The family is gathered round a table draped in a white tablecloth. On the table, there's a loaf of bread, a knife with its blade hidden behind the bread, a plate of apples, and on the floor, a container that looks like it could be holding water. Two very different paintings. But Chardin's The White Tablecloth is bursting at the seams with allusions to Lebrun's piece. In his book, No Idols, The Missing Theology of Art, Thomas Crow, who's an art historian and a professor at NYU, he picks up on these links between the two artworks. He says there are a few ways you could read these parallels between this blatantly religious painting and this apparently straightforward still life. On the one hand, maybe Chardin is taking religion down a notch, you know, transplanting the bread and wine of the Christian ritual of communion or the Eucharist into this very commonplace setting. Or maybe Chardin is doing something else completely, revealing something spiritual and profound in the ordinary. Maybe the divine dwells in the everyday.
Now, in case you're wondering if you're listening to the wrong show, yeah, maybe we're going a little bit higher brow than usual today. Can't say we've got any resident art experts here at CPX, but speaking with Thomas Crow about his love of art made us want to understand more. So in this episode of Life and Faith, we are defying the constraints of this medium and talking about visual art. You can take a look at some of the artworks we're talking about. We'll put some pictures and links on our website and on our Facebook page.
Along with Chardin and Lebrun, Professor Crow took us through more contemporary art that he insists is just as religious by people like Mark Rothko and Sister Mary Carita Kent, even if people don't always recognise it.
First, though, we wanted to ask him about this idea of the missing theology of art. What's missing and why is it missing?
There are a couple of ways it's missing. The fact that our Western idea of art, especially the notion of a self-contained painting on a framed surface, had its origins in the circulation of devotional pictures in the late Middle Ages. And the very idea of making a painting of something had a very deep Christian purpose at the beginning. And that bounded a link to the needs of Christian devotion has not actually left the art form, though at a certain juncture it became very important for everything implied by those origins to be set aside so that it could be viewed through a purely secular lens and for what people thought would be purely secular purposes.
I've heard this sort of idea before in the context of literature. So it's true to say that today, most of the people who read English literature no longer share the same worldview, the same beliefs as most of the people who wrote it.
But Professor Crow doesn't think that this gap is a problem necessarily.
What I'm finding when I've been doing events for the book is that people really love this topic, people you wouldn't expect. You go to a university audience where, you know, you think it's going to be very skeptical about anything that even smacks of religion. And there's this surprise and kind of eager interest in somebody talking about it in a way that isn't off-puttingly sectarian or evangelical.
So you don't need to have prior knowledge of Christian doctrine or religious experience to find something meaningful, even transcendent, in a piece of religious art.
In the autumn, I had a chance to spend a month and a half at the American Academy in Rome. So I got very immersed in, you know, the world headquarters of Christian art. And, of course, it's very moving. I don't find myself at all trying to distance myself or be skeptical about the way that the art worked or the fact that it touched genuine needs and feelings. I got to love the art that took those, you know, unexpected direction for the time.
One of the artworks that he's talking about here is a painting by 17th century Italian artist Caravaggio. It's called The Calling of St. Matthew. It caused quite a stir when it was first unveiled. People didn't quite know what to do with the powerful but shocking depiction of a divine moment. It was too raw and too real, and so different from the stylized and idealized beauty of the kinds of art that came before it. But eventually, even the religious authorities, the church hierarchy, would come to accept and appreciate and even be moved by what they saw in Caravaggio's work. And today, in the skeptical and secular West, people from all walks of life are still drawn to Caravaggio and Michelangelo and Da Vinci and the other creators of great religious art who still have this capacity to move us.
Caravaggio is, I think, one of the most extraordinary artists for doing that. His very first major religious painting on the Calling of Matthew. And he used to be a specialist in these kind of low-life tavern scenes. That was a popular secular genre of the time for collectors. So he just did one on a much bigger scale and put St. Matthew in the middle of it, because that was the setting. It was all this drinking, debauchery, gambling, and so on. Put him right there. And when Christ enters this dark, kind of gloomy tavern with these people slumped over and drunk and so on, and barely makes a gesture with this light coming through an upper window with a cross form in the middle of it, and it strikes Matthew, and it's just as if it's happening to you. You can actually see this transformation, this sense of some enlightenment in a painting.
Professor Crow insists that not only do you not have to be religious yourself to appreciate religious art, you don't even have to be religious to create it.
You know, Caravaggio is nobody's idea of a moral exemplar or anybody of, you know, overt piety in the slightest. He was a murderer, probably. He lived that life of the taverns and the seamy side of Italian life. But that's the story of the Calling of Matthew anyway, the calling of the tax collector who frequented such people because those were the only people who would socialize with a tax collector.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Art historian and NYU professor Thomas Crow says art is probably the last remnant of magic we have left, because we've jettisoned most of the magical beliefs that used to guide human behavior and perception of the world. But in getting rid of all those things, we left ourselves with almost no connection to the unknown.
From Caravaggio, we move towards the end of the 17th century, At this point, religious art is in decline, largely as a result of the split between Roman Catholicism and the art world. Before this split, the church was the dominant influence and chief patron of art.
It pretty much decided what kind of art was going to get done at any given time, and for an artist to make a living and to achieve recognition, you generally had to serve the interests of the church hierarchy.
But then, around the end of the 17th century, major public exhibitions of art become popular, starting in France with the Salon exhibitions at the Louvre. And this was significant,
because that meant that artists could address a larger public and gain patrons or collectors through a path that went around the church. And that really changed everything. Up to that point, to succeed, you needed the church. After that, you didn't necessarily need the church. And in fact, to be a specialist in religious art through the 18th century was seen as kind of a soft option. You know, you weren't really out there in the public sphere making your case. And so that's that split. But it was also the point when people forgot that the Christian purposes of the art were always intrinsic to it and couldn't just be dispelled, you know, with a wave of the hand. They were always going to be there.
This doesn't seem obvious to most people, including me, I have to admit. Will the Christian purposes of art always be there? What does religious art in the modern era even look like?
An artist like Mark Rothko became famous for these kind of hovering clouds of color on large format canvases. But Rothko actually started by translating early Christian art forms, in fact, very early manuscript pages from the 11th and 12th century, because he saw that his art form had begun there. And from a small manuscript page, we ended up getting these great canvases. But the thing that he started with, this recognition that his art form began in this kind of Christian illustration, can't be divorced from where the art ended up.
Mark Rothko, a contemporary of Jackson Pollock and considered one of America's most famous post-war artists. He's the artist Crowe goes to for an example of contemporary religious art that has a deeply religious purpose and was made for its time. And he was often concerned that people didn't grasp the true purpose of his work, insisted that he was not an abstractionist, but that he was deeply interested in human emotion. Rothko said, "The people who weep before my pictures are having the same religious experience that I had when I painted them."
You know, at the end of his life, Mark Rothko created these great canvases for a quasi-Byzantine chapel in Houston, and what's come to be known as the Rothko Chapel, which is almost a place of pilgrimage for lots of people now, with great diffuse sort of purplish fields, you know, 20 feet high that surround this space, which is otherwise completely unadorned inside and out. And I know my colleagues in art history may give Rothko a lot of time for most of his career, but nobody really likes the chapel that much. It just seems to have these implications of sentimentality and slightly kitschy self-realization or something. You know, one would want to stay away from that. But I felt that there was still something there, that people were touched and moved by it for a reason.
Today's religious art, then, doesn't trade on overtly religious imagery, like the illustrations of Bible stories or figures of Christ or the Madonna.
And that's one reason why I've been so interested in the printmaking of Sister Mary Carita Kent, who was an active nun in her order, the Order of the Immaculate Heart in Los Angeles. And Sister Carita has a nice quote where she says when she came into the church and entered her order and wanted to be an artist, teach art, She said there wasn't any religious art that she could respect or wanted to continue. She called it the last unflowering of the Renaissance. So just these sort of syrupy imitations of older prototypes. And so she developed her own vocabulary.
Sister Mary Carita Kent's artworks have an Andy Warhol vibe to them. For example, she took the image of a Wonder Bread wrapper and paired its slogan, "Enriched Bread," with a paraphrase of a Gandhi quote, "There are so many hungry people that God cannot appear to them except in the form of bread." This was her thing, juxtaposing advertising slogans with Bible verses or famous quotes. She hoped that people would see her work and consider the eternal.
She really belonged to this theological idea that, technically it's called analogia antis, that the world is always speaking about the eternal and the ultimate, and you see signs of it everywhere. And that was her belief, and it was, in fact, directed against her religion, or at least against her religion in the person of the Archbishop of Los Angeles, who eventually drove her out of the church and suppressed her order because of the fame and effectiveness that she had achieved with her art form.
Carita Kent's banners and posters were a feature of the civil rights and anti-war rallies of the 1960s and 70s. And it would be easy to imagine them having a place in today's protest movements for Black Lives Matter or women or refugees. And I think that's something Professor Crowe is trying to get at too. Sometimes religious art doesn't seem religious at all. Chardin's The White Tablecloth, The Calling of St. Matthew set in a lowly tavern scene, a canvas of colour, but if you look carefully, you can see the signs of something sacred.
Some of the deepest religious art, or art with the deepest theological implications, is not overtly Christian at all. It could be a still life, or it could be a little figure study of just an ordinary person, but this very similar to Sister Carita, the idea that there were signs, and you would read these ordinary things for the signs of the presence of the divine, which made it even more powerful than if you just put it in one more predictable picture of a miracle or something like that.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore.
If you want to see some of the paintings we've been talking about with Thomas Crowe, we have some pictures and links up on our website, publicchristianity.org, and our Facebook page. If you liked what you heard, we have a whole catalogue of fascinating interviews, conversations, and stories from the Life and Faith archives. To hear more, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us.
And there's plenty more there to catch up on. Just to recommend a couple, this year we've spoken with the Chair of Science and Religion at Oxford University and a man who was told he had 2 years to live close to 3 years ago. Next week, a remarkable couple who've dedicated their lives to happily fighting losing battles, but they're also winning some along the way.